Relating to the Opposite Sex Before Marriage. The ninth talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage was presented by Nancy Scott on May 24, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Series on love, sex, and dating, and the topic tonight is relating to the opposite sex before marriage. And what I want to do a little bit is, it's a continuation of the last couple weeks. I think it flows in a way in the conversation, and so I'm going to go back. Repetition is the something of learning, right? I'm always good at mixing up my metaphors, but anyway, I'm going to repeat a lot of what I've said in the past couple of weeks and then move on from there. So it's going to be somewhat of a review tonight and then kind of moving forward a little bit. Okay. So, and course-wise as well. So we've talked so far this term about marriage and about our sexuality being a natural language that communicates a commitment, and that it says that just by virtue of what it is and what it does, it communicates commitment. And it's why we respond the way that we do in the context of a sexual relationship, kind of expecting it to be more, wanting it to be more. It's just what it says. Even if we try to divorce it from that meaning, it's still there. We also talked about, therefore, that outside of the commitment of marriage, being sexual with another person is basically the trouble with that is that it's lying. It's saying a commitment with your body that you're not saying with your mind and your will. And that's where there's a problem. So we've also talked about earlier in the course that sex was created for marriage, that marriage was not created to contain sex, that like the anthropologist might argue, but that sex and marriage really are created together. The sexuality doesn't work well outside of that context, the expression of it. So where I went from there to a couple of weeks ago was talking about finding a marriage partner. What's the process? If there's just two states, married and unmarried, what I was starting with is that the way to relate to the opposite sex is through marriage primarily, as that special person, as that bond and being sexual. Marriage is the context for doing that. If we're not married, then we're not engaged in that kind of a relationship, whether it's physical or emotional. And I made the distinction that if we are emotionally committed to someone, that it's also lying, the same, maybe in a different way than our sexuality would be lying. But that emotional fornication basically is the idea that if we are committed to someone emotionally without being married to them, then we're actually also lying, because we're acting committed when we haven't actually decided with our mind and our will to be committed. And that that's a problem too. That's really not responsible and kind. And so kind of talked about that we need to have as our goal being kind to one another, and that the transition between those two states from being unmarried to being married might be a clumsy, kind of awkward, messy transition, but that we really need to look at it as that marriage is the context for having a romantic relationship. And outside of marriage is really not a place for being romantic or sexual with someone of the opposite sex. Okay, so then we talked about what does it look like to look for a marriage partner, what do you look for, the dating scheme that we've kind of grown up with, doesn't really tell us enough because we are kind of putting our best foot forward. We're presenting. We're almost like in a sales project. And so it's really not the right kind of information for deciding who is a suitable marriage partner. So we talked a little bit about considering character virtues as the primary recommendation for someone who is you're thinking about committing and joining your life with. Not so much that, and that's the trouble with dating. It's we can say all the right stuff, but friendship is actually a better context to get to know who somebody really is at the level of what their choices are and what their heart commitments are as seen through the choices that they make. So we also talked about romantic attraction a little bit and talked about romantic attraction being a really good, wonderful gift that God gives. One that draws us in, draws us toward the idea of seeing that commitment as something that I would even consider doing. But that's different than saying that it's the substance of the decision that we make. So it's a really good gift, but it's not, it shouldn't be confused with the substance of how I decide about whether or not it's wise to marry a particular person. Okay. Okay, and then last time we talked a lot about singleness and talked about the differences between sort of the choice of being single, whether by choice or by circumstance, that being single, being responsible with our needs is part of the project of being human, basically, was what I was trying to say last time. And that is that whether we're single or married, we really need to be working with how do I work with the big needs that I bring as a human and the needs that I have inside of me that I see this other person in front of me and I think they are the answer to everything I've always wanted. And we also talked about how marriage is really the natural state. We are designed for marriage. We are designed to have a partnership in that way, that we have the needs built in because of how God created us. And they're really big needs, and they're appropriate needs. And a lot of those needs can get met in the context of marriage. And we're also going to be disappointed if we think that marriage is ultimately going to be what fulfills us. So working with our needs before and during marriage is the challenge and the project that's ahead for each of us. And so looking at what our feelings have to tell us, what our drives are, what our sexuality demands or wants, and how to rein that in. We talked a little bit about that last time. So, does that all sound familiar so far? So, we have some really big feelings that happen. Loneliness, we talked a little bit about loneliness being part of the human condition, not necessarily part of the single person's. Not only for single people, but for married people as well, that loneliness is a part of being human and that we have to work with how to be responsible about how we go about trying to get our needs met in our friendships or in our marriage. So I talked a little bit last time about feelings, and perhaps we can talk more about feelings as the night goes on, but I think it's important to understand that feelings, I think, have sometimes get a bad rap, that we're supposed to not pay attention to them, they're irrational, they don't mean anything, I should certainly never act on them. And I think it's really important to understand that feelings are, emotions are part of our human makeup, and God has given them to us for a reason. And so to reject them is to reject God-given design for being human, and also to really short-circuit the information that we have available to us for making decisions and navigating this life. So it's not that emotional information is the only source of information, but they're a very valuable source of information. And coupled with our reason, our intellect, and trying to understand what those feelings mean and what they say about us can really help us have a more integrated understanding of our lives and help us make more responsible decisions. Because I think so often the way that our needs and desires and feelings work is that we decide that we're going to kind of not pay attention to that, but that very decision forces our feelings underground, and then they end up leaking out. And they show up when we least expect it, or they show up in the form of a need that I'm some way, even maybe unconsciously, manipulating to get met, rather than really knowing what it is that I'm after and understanding what that means about who I am and who God is. Okay, so we can maybe talk more about that, but I think that comes into play in our topic tonight when we talk about relating to the opposite sex before marriage. Because one of the biggest challenges of being responsible, and this whole theme is that we need to be responsible. We need to be responsible with our needs, with our feelings, with our choices. That's the challenge, is what does it look like to be responsible? And so in relating to the opposite sex before marriage, this is a context in which we get practice in that, and we get practice in being responsible and trying to work with ourselves and understand ourselves. So I'm going to suggest that this topic relating to the opposite sex before marriage is not so much, I mean, I could take this and say, this is what it should look like and define it. And of course, you guys have been around long enough to know that we don't do that very often around here. And I just want to underline that it really isn't about having a set of rules or having a line drawn so that we know how close up to it we can get before we're falling or failing. But rather, it's really about awareness, kind of an awareness of how I present myself, how I come across to the opposite sex, what I'm saying without saying something. It's all about awareness, and that's going to look different for different people. It's not really something that's going to lend itself to a set of rules that are going to apply in every situation. So the goal, if the goal is awareness, then what we're trying to be aware for is kind of a commitment to be respectful, to respect each other, to respect ourselves, to act in a way that is consistent with what we say we believe. The goal is not success, but rather the goal is growth. So growth, having our faith grow as a result of struggling with different choices and working to understand. It's in that context that we grow in our desire for what's good. We grow in our desire for wisdom and truth. It's not so much about avoiding failure as it is about having our failures teach us what's so important for us to know and what's important in life and what's and what we want. So finding out who God is and what He values, and then finding out about in what ways do my values line up with His. I think this whole life project is this journey of understanding how far apart those two things are, and having the process of my life and the even the pain and the disappointment and the deprivation of needs that we talked about last time be the vehicle through which God actually brings my desires closer to what His are, because He's reshaping my view of reality, He's reshaping my view of myself, of what's really important in this life. And in the course of this journey that we're on, we end up closer to understanding who God is and what's really important here than when we started out. And I think that's success. So, not necessarily keeping a set of rules. So, that said, I am going to talk a little bit about what might be helpful and what might be not helpful. And I don't want to put firm lines down or anything, but just in terms of encouraging awareness, there's some things that I think we could dial up the volume on our awareness, kind of being aware of how things are communicated and what comes across. So let's take dress, for example. I think dress is a really... I think we're in a time and place where fashion is extremely sexualized right now. Thanks to whatever forces out there, pop star idols or whoever, fashion is really very provocative these days. And so to be stylish almost means to look, for women, to look really provocative. And I think it's really important for us as women to understand and be respectful of our own bodies and also of what we are saying with how we dress. So it isn't that we don't ever get to be stylish, but I would suggest that that buying into the notion that that style requires cleavage, for example, is maybe not something we need to buy into. So, and I think that in our culture, breasts just are very sexualized. And so in another culture, cleavage might not mean the same thing that it means as it does here. But here, it means something. And I think even myself as in my younger days, I really struggled with the choice that I had to make about what I could wear based on how other people would take it, because that limits my freedom. I was quite a case back then. But my freedom was like, what do you mean I can't wear what I want to wear just because it might say something? But I think it's the fact is that we just need to know that we are going to be saying that, whether it's our intention or not, and whether it's right or not, whether it's fair or not, it just is. And dress is something that is so culturally determined that in another culture we might be able to do things really differently. That's what I'm saying about. I always remember with fondness and laughing kind of Elizabeth Elliot's story about working with the Warani Indians who were basically naked. They wore a string around their waist. That was all they wore. And she worked with them long enough to finally ask someone in the group, so why do you guys wear this string around your waist? She couldn't understand that. And the answer was, well, you wouldn't want us to go around naked. And so in that culture, that was what being clothed meant. There were no other clothes, just the string around their waist. And so they carried on life looking like that, you know, that was fine. And so they were not sexualized in their nakedness. They still had very much tribal rituals about sexuality and things that were okay, who that was okay to do it with and who wasn't. And marriage was, you know, a part of their custom as well. So anyway, it just kind of underlines that that dress is very much culturally determined. And my main point is just that in our culture today, I think that that we live in such a sexualized culture that we just really need to be aware of what we might be saying with how we dress. So kind of really being aware of that. Okay, so deciding what you want to communicate with how you dress and then doing that, being consistent. So I think that's another really important thing. And it has, I think it's still really possible to be attractive and feminine and be to enjoy beauty. That's a different thing, and that's a good thing. But to really be aware of what we communicate. So another big area is just the area of flirting, kind of being aware of how I interact with men or women, depending on, you know, who I'm interested in. Let's see if I can think of an example. Kind of a, I mean, everybody knows what it's like to be flirted with, and everybody knows what it's like to flirt. And it's like there's this little dose of this possibility in the air, and because it's right there in front of me, I'm going to work it. And I think a lot of times we are not aware of how we do that either. We can be extremely inviting and flirtatious in our body language, in our posture, in the kinds of things we talk about, perhaps. We can be very suggestive in all kinds of nonverbal ways that I think we really need to be willing to listen to and understand and be aware of how it might come across. And again, the main thing, I think, is self-awareness. So it isn't that I have to take on, wow, this person's flirting with me, I should tell them that's not okay. That's not it. It's more, this person's flirting with me, and I'm kind of flirting back. And what am I doing with that? And what do I want to do with that? And and just really being aware of how that might show me what I long for, what I want, that's really appropriate, but maybe not appropriate for this interaction. So again, it's sort of like wanting to be responsible with our needs and with our desires in a way that are kind to the other person. Because I think too often what flirting is it's tantalizing in a way, but it's also kind of offering something that I might not really be wanting to offer. It might be offering something I really can't deliver. And I think a lot of times we back ourselves into these circumstances where then something happens or or it goes further than we intended, and we can often have the response of, well, how did that happen? You know, I didn't want that. I didn't ask for that. And it's just really important that we know that on a certain level we were inviting it, because that's important to know. So being conscious, being deliberate, being aware of body language, posture, distance between people, it's all very subjective. Again, it's not like there's rules, but I'm encouraging us to ask the question and to be aware of what this looks like. That brings us to the idea of making choices and what our choices are. I talk with people from time to time who talk about having an experience of, well, it just happened. We ended up kissing. We didn't really intend it to happen. We didn't want it, you know, we didn't really decide on it or anything. It just happened. It just happened. I mean, how many of us have had that experience? It's like, it just happens. But the fact is, we make choices. And I think it's really important that we know we're making choices when we're making them. And that even the not making a choice is making a choice. So to go forward toward a situation or an experience that I know from previous experience or I just know from intuition is probably going in a direction that I might not want it to go in, but it feels so good, I'm not going to stop it. I really want this to happen on some level, but I can't really say I want it or say, what are we doing? Can we do this? Is this right? I mean, it's like that would break the mood. That might send it away, and I don't want to do that. It's like I want that thing so badly, I can't interrupt the train that's going. Is that anybody resonating with that? So I think it's really important that we know that we are choice makers, and that we have choices all along the continuum, and we're responsible for the choices that we make. So we need to consider, if that happens, then we need to consider what choices led up to it just happening. What are some wiser ways to interact with someone, or that maybe 1 o'clock in the morning in the dark on my couch is not the best way to have a conversation with someone of the opposite sex, because it just does communicate a layer of intimacy that invites being physical. And so it didn't just happen. I actually made choices to be in the room, to go in that direction. Does that make sense? It's like we really need to pay attention along the way and to be deliberate in the choices that we're making. Okay. So what does it look like to be friends with someone? If being friends is the way to relate to the opposite sex before marriage, then what does that look like? We've talked a little bit about that already, and I think we can maybe expand on it a bit, but I think mainly we have friendships that we can compare it to, that we know if I have a friendship with someone that's not romantic, then I know what friendship looks like that's appropriate, because non-romantic friendship is never not appropriate. I mean, it's like friendship is a good thing. It's a wonderful gift, and to be able to share experiences, to be able to enjoy common interests with someone. It doesn't get murky until there's, you know, that romantic stuff going on. And that's when we get confused about what we should be doing and what's appropriate and what's going on here and all this. But I think to help tread that water, or to help navigate that process, we can compare our friendships, that the ones that are not romantic. Like, what choices would I be making about spending time with this person if I weren't interested in them? If it were Paul instead of George that I was, you know, if it's like I'm attracted to Paul, I'm not attracted to George. George and I can just be friends and we just know it and it's fine. So what kind of choices do you make about hanging out with him that might inform the decisions that you have of hanging out with this other person that you do have feelings about? So kind of navigating that, knowing that that's going to drive some of your decisions, and really working at reining that in and being responsible with understanding even the way in which those feelings are there to tell you something. They're there to tell you something about what you want, what you long for, what you need. They might even be telling you that's the person that you actually want to commit your life to. But in the absence of making a decision outside of those feelings, that's not going to be the basis on which that decision is made. So if we're confused about how to relate in a particular friendship, then I think it can be really helpful to talk about it. Not with that person, but with another person that you trust. Somebody that can be objective, somebody that can help you know what's at stake for you, kind of help you process it, help you understand where you are, so that you can take responsibility for where you are and gain clarity on yourself and your position. Does that make sense? Also wanted to talk for a minute about knowing that we are sexual people in the midst of not having an expression for it. Being single people and not having an appropriate expression for our sexuality, what does it look like to be a human who is sexual? I think that there's a lot of ways that we can work with the energy that we know is sexual energy, same way we might work with anger or aggression. There's ways we can express that energy apart from actually being sexual. So even the textbooks have a word for it called sublimation, and that is that we direct this energy into something different. And it can be a conscious decision and a good decision that, okay, I have this energy. What can I do with that energy? Maybe I can express it by working harder at helping people, or deciding how to give to someone who I feel generous toward. It's like there's a lot of giving in our sexual expression, and so giving in appropriate ways to a cause or something like that. I mean, I don't want that to sound too trite, but I think there really is value in understanding how our sexuality works and what the energy is for us. And beyond that, kind of just knowing what that feels like and not being afraid of it, but just letting it inform our choices and informing our understanding of ourselves in a way that is wise. So that's really about all I have to say. To make a conclusion, I just want to underline again that I'm not putting out these suggestions to say that there's a way to get it right. It's not really about getting it right. It's about growing. It's not getting it right so that the formula works to get me what I want, which is marriage, or so that God finally rewards me with marriage. But rather, it's about seeking wisdom, because that is ultimately what our life project should be. And whatever context, whatever gift we find ourselves in, whether it's the gift of being single or the gift of being married, that's the context that God has for us to work out what it means to want goodness, to want wisdom, to seek truth. So It's not about getting it right, but it's about seeking wisdom and growing into wanting what God wants and seeing clearly where our hearts don't share his desires. Because that shows us our need for mercy. And ultimately, that's going to be the most important thing we can ever understand about ourselves, is how deeply we need mercy. God gives marriage. God gives the absence of marriage. He gives the meeting of our needs. He gives the deprivation of our needs. As we continue on this journey, what we're up against is figuring out what we think about that, what we're going to do with the idea that we are creatures and that God is ultimately directing our lives. And in the midst of that, we have choices to make about how we relate to one another and how we decide to love each other and to try to be loving. So that's what I have to say. We have time to have a conversation if you're interested. Any comments, questions?
You talked about clothing, and will you talk a little bit more about that, especially about how culture changes? How culture changes?
Okay.
Because, I mean, to what you said, I can hear many arguments that, well, that's the way it is now, and it's not provocative because that's the way everyone dresses.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. I mean, even in that Indian culture, at some point, it seems like at some point something changed so that they were just wearing strings.
They what?
So that they were just wearing strings.
That they got there somehow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't provocative.
Right.
I see.
So
if we all dress like Britney Spears for long enough, it won't be
right.
Titillating. It depends. It depends on what it means. I think in the culture that we live in, that kind of dressing means let's have sex. I mean, it's like that's what the ad is saying, that's what the song is saying, that's what it's all wrapped up in that. If it were separated from that, could she dress like that? Maybe. And would culture change to where it doesn't mean that? Maybe.
So maybe it's more has to do with like cultural beliefs than cultural standards?
Mm-hmm. Yes, because I think that's what it's all tied up in, is the meaning of that expression. And the way we've gotten the meaning of it so far is through our image-driven media and the songs that are performed and the content of the songs. I mean, the songs are about having sex. So it's pretty clear that it's connected. I think we're making a connection that's really there in our culture. Is that helpful? Is that kind of...
Nancy, you mentioned, or you guys just made a distinction between cultural differences. But is the... And earlier you talked about that sex is a natural language.
Mm-hmm.
Does the natural language, is that a universal or cultural? Does it have cultural distinctions as well? Physicality and... Can you describe the... whether or not that natural language has some cultural separations as well, like you've just been describing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think it probably, what leads up to being sexual probably is very culturally determined on some levels, but I do think that sex as a natural language that communicates a different kind of relationship than the kind I have with the other people in the community, I think that's a pretty universal thing. I don't have the anthropological studies to back me up on that, but I think at its core, if that's what it's saying and that's what it does, and I think you could look at a lot of different cultures and find that they do put a very high meaning on the sexual relationship and on marriage. In a lot of cultures, marriage is recognized, even if it's polygamous or lots of different marriage partners. There's a definition for where sex is appropriate, and I think there's a certain I think that the way that God created our sexuality to be that kind of a language even in a culture that doesn't recognize it that way, in some way it's still saying that to the people involved. So now how we get there, what the customs are surrounding it, can all be very, very much culturally determined. Is that helpful?
Well, I just hoping you could clarify something for me. You were talking about with flirting, how the body language and posture and whatever else, I'm saying something to another person. Mm-hmm. And were you saying that I should be conscious of how that person might be reading me or what my intent might be?
The latter.
What my
intent it might be.
Okay.
So I can't really take responsibility for how the other person receives me, but I can take responsibility for what I'm communicating. So I really need to be aware of what's going on for me. If I notice that I'm, even if I'm flirting in response to someone or if I'm starting it, it's like, what's going on for me here? And to turn the volume up on my own awareness. So what do you guys think of all this? Is it, you just think, well, that sounds great, but who's going to do that? Who's going to live that way?
This is kind of piggybacking on what Carl said. Like, I think that this is what you're meaning, so tell me.
Mm-hmm.
That the awareness, like, isn't just, like, what we're communicating to people as far as, like, we have to be paranoid about what they're going to think about us as
right.
much as, like, what are we trying to say?
Yes.
Like, 'cause I think that there are a lot of people who would agree with what you're saying, but they would take it in, we're responsible for how people react to us,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we
right.
can do that. And
right.
I don't think that's what you're saying.
Right.
So I just wanted to clarify that
that's right.
what you're saying is, like,
yeah.
we have to be aware of ourselves and what
mm-hmm.
we're trying to say,
mm-hmm.
and we can't, like, I can't take responsibility for how anyone reacts to me. Like, if I'm trying to make them do that, yeah, that's my fault. But if I'm just doing what I need to do, and, like, they read that a funny way, like, I can't do anything about that.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think that makes it very doable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's helpful.
But on the other end, you said that the clothing we wear just does communicate. And we have to be aware that it communicates.
Mm-hmm.
We have to take responsibility for what we're communicating when we wear clothes
yeah.
that are provocative. So in that sense, what is my intention? My intention might not be to be provocative, but if I'm wearing clothes that communicate that I look just like Britney Spears, then
mm-hmm.
that's what I'm communicating. And I think you can say the same thing for actions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would go so far
mm-hmm.
as to say that if you, you know, like you're 1 o'clock in the morning in a dark room on a sofa, just communicate something, regardless if that's my intent
right.
or not.
Right.
It just does communicate something. So there's a balance there,
mm-hmm.
and maybe it wasn't my intention to communicate anything, but here I am at 2 a.m. in a dark room with somebody who's been flirting with me, and
mm-hmm.
I'm communicating something by just being there in the room with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good clarification. I think it's just really, it's about deciding. I mean, I think in this area, especially in our, I think another piece of what our culture feeds us is that, you know, you can't help it if you fall in love. It just happens. It just happens. And I can't help it that I fell in love with somebody who was married because I'm a victim to this thing. And I just want to really speak against that and say, you know what? Sure, after I'm married, I'm not dead. I might find somebody else other than my spouse attractive. I might even find that I'm drawn to them. I might even have romantic feelings. What am I going to do with that? What's right to do with that? Well, it's right to be committed to my spouse. That's what's right. And so I don't feed that thing. And I do have a choice. And it didn't just happen. I fed it. I nurtured it. I coaxed it along. And I'm having an affair. Oh no, how did that happen? It just happened. And so I'm just saying, I think the same thing is true before marriage, that we do that because we want it, and it's right to want it, but let's be wise about it. Let's decide we want it and find marriage and decide on marriage and not go with sequential committed relationships that end in brokenness and you know, it's again, like I said a couple weeks ago, I don't think our goal is not to avoid pain. Our goal is to be wise and to be caring And it just is cruel on a certain level to myself and to the other person to act like I'm married to them when I'm not. Because the fact is, it can end. And if it does end, it's a divorce. It's a very painful experience to break up with someone that you've been that committed with. It's emotional divorce. So it's very difficult.
I don't think I'm alone in this, but I grew up without a lot of direction. Mm-hmm. My sexuality hit me completely unawares. I wasn't prepared for the strength of the feelings, the way it grounds out everything else. I liken it to a fire that doesn't have a contained area to burn safely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really delighted to hear the clarity and wisdom that it's taken me a lifetime to learn, often the hard way. But this is good stuff.
Nancy, I think you briefly mentioned in the beginning something about marriage being the natural state, and I was a little confused about that. And I was wondering also if you could speak a little bit to, I think Paul is stating in 1 Corinthians something about, I guess, it's better for a man not to be married, and he goes on to say a few things about that.
Mm-hmm.
Would you be able to speak a little bit to that?
Mm-hmm. I'll try. I should have done my homework and reviewed that passage, guessing that it might come up. I haven't looked at it in a while. I think that we're created to be married, and that that is the natural state. That's kind of what I was suggesting. Paul is speaking in that passage into a particular circumstance in a particular setting, where he's, if I could even read the passage, I might remember. Dave, do you remember?
I have a Bible. I'll be glad to look.
Okay, cool. Have you studied this passage? I'm going to call on you.
Chapter 7.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 7. Yeah, well, actually, I'm just going to read, the passage, and it might actually speak for itself fairly well. He's clarifying various issues with them in the context. He's talking about, he's discouraging lawsuits. He's kind of saying, all things are lawful for me, not all things are profitable. It's that section. And then he goes on to talk about fleeing immorality, and the body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. He's really, in this whole book, correcting places where the Corinthians have really been infiltrated by the culture surrounding them. So that's sort of the broader context.
What's
now,
the
on
address?
Chapter 7.
What's the address?
Oh, the address?
Yeah.
1 Corinthians 7? Yeah.
Seven.
Verse 1 is where I'm going to start. Yeah, sorry. Thank you. That was chapter 6 that I reviewed. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. But because of immoralities, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to his wife, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Stop depriving one another, except by agreement for a time that you may devote yourselves to prayer, and come together again, lest Satan tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But this I say by way of concession, not of command. Yet I wish that all men were even as I myself am. However, each man has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. But if they do not have self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. But to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does leave, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not send his wife away. I won't keep going, but it goes on a little bit more. It seems to me that what he's talking about is this circumstance that he's writing into and trying to kind of help them see what a godly view of their circumstances. So he's saying, they also, I think I remember, they had this practice where they decided that abstaining from their sexuality was somehow warranted or somehow a higher virtue than not. And so that's where he's addressing, no, this is really right that in your marriage you stop depriving one another, and it's really not, maybe for a time to devote yourself to prayer or something like that, but that it's really not virtuous to abstain from sexual intimacy. And so he's kind of correcting them. And I think the part where he's talking about to the unmarried and to the widows, I'd have to look at that more. I haven't looked at it in a while. But it's he's kind of got the sense that this is the last days, and there's a lot of work to do, and there's sort of an urgency to the work that he sees getting the gospel out. And I think that's part of what, if I remember, is motivating him saying, to the unmarried and to the widows, don't occupy yourselves with that stuff, but rather occupy yourselves with what I'm occupied with, which is bringing the gospel to the world. So, but he's also saying that that if you do want to get married, it's okay. I mean, that's kind of what he's saying. It's if you don't want to live with deprivation, or you don't have self-control, then the right thing to do is to be married. And that's really right and natural. I mean, I think he's actually supporting the idea that marriage is the natural state by saying that, you know, if you can go without it and work hard for the kingdom, great, go for it. But if you don't want to do that, that's okay. You can do what you desire, and what's actually wiser, if you have that desire and you're going to struggle to have self-control with it, it's actually wiser to be married and to have an outlet for that and to have a connection for that. Is that, yeah. Did I do any justice
great.
To that?
Great.
Great. Okay, good. Thanks.
The sort of naturalness of the mm-hmm. marriage, I think the place where we would see the naturalness of God's intention that the norm is mm-hmm. For men and women to marry one another as opposed to living singly goes way back to the garden. Basically.
Yes, maybe to Genesis. I didn't tonight. So. Yeah, I think that's really right. I mean, the creation itself kind of puts that forth. And you know, the whole story of Adam going through all the animals and not finding someone to really connect with, and having woman created. I mean, I think that men and women are this amazing creation that together fully complement the image of God on some level. I mean, it's just really a beautiful creation. So that's where I get the naturalness. So, is that helpful? Okay. Yeah. Other thoughts, questions?
So you were just saying that Paul says, if you want to be married, get married.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not a contradiction, but it sounds, I mean, earlier in past weeks, I thought you were saying, like, maybe you want to be married, but God hasn't given that to you, so you just need to wait. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you think mm-hmm. that Paul is looking at that? I mean,
help me understand.
In saying that Paul's saying, if you want to be married, get married.
Yeah.
Versus, you want to be married, and God hasn't given that to you.
Right.
How do you reconcile those two?
Okay. I think I get... Let me see if this...
I mean...
It seems like a contradiction that Paul is saying, if you want to be married, be married. But what's this having to wait for God to pull it off?
Right.
Or it's like, how come if I want to be married, I end up not married? Is that kind of... Okay.
Or I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I know people who want to be married, so they find someone else who wants to be married and get Right.
And just get married. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay.
Oh, really?
To get married.
But I mean,
think it's a really good thing to get married. I mean, I don't think it would be so good if it happens in a way that maybe you're talking about that. What are you doing Friday night? Let's go get married. I mean, but to really take on that, my friendships, I'm in my friendships, I'm evaluating potential life partners, and I'm looking for that. I want that. I might not. I mean, I have to be aware and responsible with how my needs come out in that, because I can certainly be very grabby in the process, and that's not going to be kind to anyone. But to be working with the needs that I have and the desires that I have, I guess part of what I'm trying to say is I think it's really natural and even God-given and right that we want to be married, and that we make choices in that direction. So
maybe here's a question that gets at it. Let's say Joe really wants to be married, but mm-hmm. there's no one around to mm-hmm. be married to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, would you give him the advice to go meet people, maybe? Meet some new people? Or, I mean, mm-hmm. I know people who, you know...
Match.com.
Well, I know people who really want to be married, but who circle of people is like 10 people, and there's mm-hmm. no one in that circle
yeah.
you want to marry.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, the question is always like, well, do they just wait for friend number, you know, person number 11 to walk into their lives, or do they
mm-hmm.
try and
yeah.
pursue different relationships?
Yeah. Do they what?
Like, try and pursue, like, other relationships,
okay.
like other people.
Right,
like,
right.
Meeting new people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really difficult to know, but I think when Paul is saying, if you want to be married, be married, I think he's talking to people that are probably, like, already couples, or like, you know, maybe they already have somebody in mind, and they're asking, well, you know, Paul is saying that we really should abstain from sexuality. Sex is not the way to go, and so we really need to just not go there. I think that's more the context that he's speaking into, so it might make more sense that he's saying, if you want to be married, be married. There, you're, you know, God is giving this to you to have. Now, in the situation that you're talking about and the one that we find ourselves in our culture a lot, is there's not people knocking down the door, and there's not really availability. And I think that is something I really have to work with to be responsible with. I guess I would ask the question, how do my choices play into my not meeting people? Am I hesitant about meeting people? Am I reserved about meeting people? I think it really is okay to take risks and to try to get to know people. And we could be really holding ourselves back because we might expect that it's going to look a certain way or something like that, or even waiting to have a crush on someone or be smitten or have a friend say, what about this person? Let's set you up. Or I don't know what we maybe expect, but I do think, when I mentioned Match.com kind of in joking, it is a very interesting phenomenon to me right now that that this is becoming more and more the way that people meet. I've met with a variety of couples who met through the internet, and I don't know what that indicates exactly culturally. Certainly, I might suggest that it indicates a breakdown of our communities, that we no longer have the village around us that we're meeting people. And the internet is kind of becoming this village of some kind, but I don't know about all that. But I do think it's a big challenge. I remember a dear friend of mine who was also single in her 30s. We were in our 30s together and kind of working with, wow, you know, I didn't think this would happen. What's going on here? And she had a job working at a girls' camp full-time. She did that year-round. Well, not a lot of men to meet. But she really felt strongly that that was her calling. and that she really would love to be married, she would love to meet guys, well, leave it to God to bring the camp doctor along, you know. And they ended up married. So I don't think that, I always think of her when I think of, well, what are the odds? You know, it's like we gotta balance the odds out or something, or find a context to meet more men. You know, it's like, I don't have enough men that I'm meeting, you know, so I need to go out and meet some men. I always think of her as an example of, on a very profound level, God doesn't need us to go to match.com. You know, it's like, does that mean it's a wrong thing to do? I'm not ready to say that. But I do think it's really appropriate that we work with our deprivation and that we work with our fears, so kind of the hand in hand of those, that our deprivation could drive us to emailing 10 people all at once because I'm so wanting it. I just can't go without it. And that drive, like Bill was saying, I mean, the power of that longing inside of us and our sexuality, our hormones combining with it, is overpowering. It's just huge. And for that deprivation to drive that kind of pursuit is something that is really normal and natural and also really something to be reckoned with, something to be held in, something to be worked with, so that I can tease out how much of this is that and how much of this is wisdom saying, this is a really good match for me. Now, on the that's the deprivation side. What about on the fear side? If I have these huge fears going into relating to the opposite sex because of whatever experience I've had or not had, and I've been told that purity requires that I never have a conversation that might go toward getting to know someone, then my fears could very much hold me back from ever putting myself out there. And then I can kind of look at that and say, well, God just isn't providing. I think that would be just as much of a mistake, really, because it's not giving me the opportunity to see how my fears are playing into that and how my hesitation is really limiting. Because being in relationships, being in friendships, is full of risk, full of peril. And we are not going to do it well, and we're going to bumble through it, and on both sides. We're going to go back and forth, both sides. We're just going to be who we are and trying to work it out along the way. So is that kind of,
yeah, that's helpful? Really helpful, especially I love the part about,
yeah, risk.
I think, yeah, like, I mean, we do have those things driving us, but... Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have, like, those needs and those desires driving us, but, I mean, mm-hmm, the fear and the risk is very much also, yeah, can be driving us as well.
Yes.
And sometimes,
yes,
we don't really, like, look at that or stop, mm-hmm, and think about that.
Yes. I think that's really good. I'm glad that it came up because it's a part of what I was talking about a little bit last time about fear of marriage. That I think we do live in a time when we very much fear marriage as something that is just nobody succeeds anymore. You know, over half of marriages end in divorce. It's very difficult, the place that we are right now. And I think as believers, as Christians, we might have a pretty good model of how to get toward marriage or what we think about marriage. We might have a pretty good model. But I think there is a lot of fear brought into kind of this idea that we have to do it right, or that doing it a certain way is going to give us God's reward, or that, I mean, it's just all, it's like it can paralyze us into thinking, I don't know how to do this, so I'm just not even stepping up. I'm just not even going to go there. And I think that would be equally unfortunate.
Maybe this is just because this is my, like, soapbox thing, but you were talking about how all of your friendships with members of the opposite sex are, in a sense, like, evaluating a potential marriage partner, and I totally understand what you're saying about that. Like, that is true. But I also kind of wanted to I think this was kind of sparked by Melanie's question. Like, in your friendships with people, it seems like it's really important to realize that you're not just looking for a marriage partner. Like, you're in your whole life, you're going to be having friends. And especially as a young adult, I think it's really important to not always be thinking, well, this is a potential marriage partner, as much as it is to be like, I need to have really good friends, and I need to feel like I need to know people. I want them to know me. I want them to be supportive of me. I want to support them. I want to be involved in their lives. And to realize that that's what being married is, only to the nth degree, like that you are best friends like forever, you know, that whole thing. Like, being married is being somebody's friend, and it's more than that, but it's
fundamentally that.
Yeah, and I think that that just by being friends with people, you are, like, you're going to know them, and I don't think you have to have in the back of your mind, like, oh, this is a potential marriage partner. I don't think that's what you're saying.
No.
But that, like, that can be helpful for finding a marriage partner, but, like, that's not your end goal. And if your end goal in your friendships is finding a marriage partner, you might not be looking at things very objectively either. So that just, that's a really tricky thing, too, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly requires working at being responsible. Because even if I know that that's what I'm doing, or I think that, you know, I know that I'm hungry for that, it's really not appropriate to put that onto a friendship, necessarily.
I mean, right. And I get really insulted if people, like, just want to be my friends because they like me. Like, that's so insulting to me. And, like, I really, like, I wouldn't ever marry somebody who was my friend just because they wanted to marry me. Like, that would just freak me out. Like, you have to like me and want to be my friend even if I wouldn't marry you. Like, otherwise, like, why would I even do that? I don't know. I just think that seems very, like, manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
That's all.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Anybody else? Thoughts? Comments?
I think this is related, but the level of maturity that we're at has a lot to say about the values checklist that we keep in the back of our mind when we're related to people. And if what I value is a tight sweater or broad shoulders or whatever, I'm probably not going to be in the best shape to make a marriage decision yet.
It's a really good, it's a really good illustration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, it's like we have to come to a place, and in fact, even just readiness to make a decision like that will involve understanding those kind of choices, that that what might have been important to me when I was 16, really different things are important to me when I'm 25. And even other things are important to you when you're 40 or when you're 60. It's like the things that stay the course are the things that you want to look at in a marriage. It's like, it's not because you're not going to know yourself. You're not going to know the other person. You're not going to know yourself because you're going to learn all that on the way. But to really be looking for those kind of qualities, that are beyond the surface, that are bigger than that. And fundamentally, I think one of the things we talked about was, I think the pursuit of self-awareness is a really big one, because in marriage, the one thing that can kill a marriage is, like Larry was, I think, was it Larry saying, the finger, the pointing, the blaming is the quickest marriage killer, is not being able to own responsibility, take responsibility appropriately, either not too much or not enough. So, thanks. Anybody else? Closing thoughts? Well, thanks. I think we have one more week of the series next week. I think it might be Jack is finishing out next week. Thanks. We'll see you.